From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
This one goes out to the one I love.
On today's Fresh Air, Michael Stipe, R.E.M.'s lead singer and songwriter. His new book pays tribute to Patti Smith, the singer and songwriter who inspired him to perform. We'll talk about his photos of Patti Smith and his own life in music. And Maureen Corrigan reviews A Widow for 1 Year, the new novel by John Irving, the author of The World According to Garp. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. India conducted 3 underground nuclear tests today, its first in more than 2 decades. Afterward, the Indian government said the test proved that it has nuclear weapons capability, but the government says it remains committed to nuclear disarmament. But that statement is unlikely to ease concerns in neighboring Pakistan. The two countries have fought 3 wars in the last 50 years. Pakistan last month accused India of having a nuclear weapon and said it would respond by strengthening its defenses. At the White House, Press Secretary Mike McCurry said the Indian nuclear tests go against the overwhelming international commitment to ban such testing. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is back in the Balkans on a round of shuttle diplomacy to try to help resolve the worsening crisis in Kosovo. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Pristina that a low-level conflict is already underway in Serbia's troubled province.
Both official Serbian sources and leaders of the ethnic Albanians are issuing daily reports of deaths and casualties. Yesterday, 1 Serbian policeman was killed. 2 bombs were thrown at shops owned by Albanians. A hydroelectric power plant was shut down for security reasons, and the main east-west highway is shut down for the 4th consecutive day. Moderate Albanians acknowledge that the armed rebels of the Kosovo Liberation Army are gaining ground. Some estimate the KLA controls as much as 35% of Kosovo territory. The surge in strength and popularity of the armed separatists is seen as having narrowed possibilities for a political dialogue between Kosovo Albanians and Serb authorities in Belgrade. This is Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Pristina.
Indonesia's President Suharto has warned leaders from the group of 15 developing nations meeting in Cairo that Asia's financial turbulence could spread to other parts of the world. Dale Gavlak reports.
President Suharto called for greater global cooperation to stave off the dangers posed by economic and social turmoil rattling Southeast Asia for the past 10 months. He spoke through an interpreter.
We are therefore convinced that there is a dire need to intensify international cooperation if the Asian crisis is to be overcome and if its impact is to be mitigated.
Suharto did not mention violent protests raging throughout Indonesia, calling for an end to his 32-year rule. A sharp fuel price hike to meet a $40 billion bailout package by the IMF has sparked massive student demonstrations. Suharto is under increasing pressure to step down, with a prominent Muslim leader and dissidents now demanding his resignation. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
The Postal Rate Commission has decided to boost the cost of a first-class stamp by a penny to 33 cents. The increase could take effect by late summer. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 99 points at 9,154 in active trading. The Nasdaq is up 3. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Wall Street is surging today just after the opening bell. The Dow gained over 100 points. Investors are reacting favorably to various corporate merger announcements today. NPR's Madeline Brand has more.
News of the biggest telecommunications merger ever helped fuel this morning's trading. SBC Communications says it's buying Ameritech in a stock swap worth more than $60 billion. The deal would create the country's largest local phone company with operations in 13 states. Other company news, Seagram is reportedly buying PolyGram, the world's largest record company, for nearly $10 billion. And DuPont says it's divesting itself of oil company Conoco. Sunbeam had some disappointing news. Revenues are down for the first quarter, and the company says it will lay off 6,400 workers in an effort to restore profitability. Madeline Brand, NPR News, Washington.
DuPont says it is selling its 20% stake in the energy unit Conoco to the public as part of the chemical maker's goal to exit the oil and gas business. The sale will come via an initial public offering sometime before the end of the year, and DuPont officials say the company will divest its remaining interest in Conoco as soon as possible. There's more consolidation today in the oil and gas industry. Oil service firm Baker Hughes has announced that it is buying Western Atlas for $5.5 billion in stock. The combined company will retain the Baker Hughes name. A new congressional report recommends that the United States halt imports of fruits, vegetables, and other foods from countries that do not meet U.S. food safety standards. The report, prepared by the General Accounting Office, says the Food and Drug Administration should require foreign exporters to adopt equivalent food safety standards, but some industry groups say such a move could trigger a backlash from trading partners. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Michael Stipe, the lead singer and songwriter of the band R.E.M. The band was formed in 1980, and for several years it was a critic's favorite with a devoted following among alternative rock listeners. But despite its emphasis on making non-commercial music, R.E.M. went on to become a commercial success as well. Michael Stipe has been an inspiration to musicians starting their own bands. Now Stipe pays tribute to the performer who most influenced him. Stipe has a new book of photos of Patti Smith. He took the pictures in 1995 over a two-week period when he accompanied Smith on her tour with Bob Dylan. Patti Smith sang a duet with Stipe on R.E.M.'s most recent album, New Adventures in Hi-Fi. Let's start with part of that track.
Look up. What do you see? All of you, all of me, first and starring. Some of them, they surprise. I can't look it in the eyes. Second off Spanish fly, I said kerosene, cherry flavored neck and car. I can smell the sorrow on your breath. Sweat, victory, song, and smell fame. I got it. Like fear, adrenaline, puts us near. Liminal, tastes like fear.
Michael Stipe, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In your new book, you write that the first time you found out about Patti Smith, you were in detention study hall at your high school in Collinsville, Illinois, just outside East St. Louis, and you were 15. Tell us the story of how you did discover Patti Smith.
There was an article that that the writer Lisa Robinson had written about the CBGB scene in New York, which was just starting, I think, in 74, 75 was when it really kicked in with Patti and bands like Television, and I think the Talking Heads and Blondie came a little bit later, but she wrote an article comparing that scene to the music of the time, saying that the music of the time was very technicolor and very blown out and very colorful, and this was very stripped down and visceral and raw, and much more like black and white TV, like a staticky old TV. And there was a photograph of Patti Smith leaning against a wall, looking at the camera, and the picture was so so haunting and so mesmerizing. I think I immediately felt, you know, like there was something here that was worth investigating. And so I started trying to find out about this music and trying to find out about these people that were making it, and bought her first record the day it came out. And it was very epiphanal. I decided then and there that music was what I wanted to do with my life.
So at this point, did you have any sense that you could sing or that you could write songs?
Not really. I played accordion when I was in third grade. I really wanted to play organ, but they ran out of organ, so I played accordion. But I never really sang, you know, very much, and I didn't really have an idea of what I wanted to do with my life. But the punk ethic in the mid-70s, when all this stuff was going on, Patti Smith and Television are really the two bands that I look to. The ethic was kind of do-it-yourself, that anybody could do what they were doing. It didn't take a special person to do it, and I took that very literally and decided then and there at the age of 15 or 16 that I was going to be a singer.
Excuse me for being sidetracked here for a moment, but accordion, what were you playing on those accordion books? Did you have one of those beginning accordion books with the horrible songs in it?
I don't think I could read them. I mean, I don't think I could read the music, but my third grade class, Mrs. Swindle was our teacher, had a band, and we would play various songs of the day. I think the Green Green Grass of Home and stuff like that. And me and my best friend, Mike Rooney, played accordion. And at one point we asked Mrs. Swindle if we could yell things out because we weren't allowed to sing. We had to play the accordion. I guess that took greater concentration than singing. But we asked if we could yell things out like, "Go, Daddy-O." And so the two of us would stand on the side, and in the middle of the Green, Green Grass of Home, we'd be like, "Yeah, man, yeah, go, Daddy-O."
Oh, that's really great.
That was my auspicious musical beginnings. But I just decided, I felt like I had discovered something that I felt very much a part of at that pretty young age. And I stuck to it.
So when you heard Patti Smith and you decided that it was going to be about music for you, what did that inspire you to do? Did you start trying to perform right away or buying more records? Like, what direction did it lead you in?
I bought records. And you know, in 1976, it was really hard to find those kind of records. And so, you know, the search was kind of part of the fun. I remember the day that her record came out, I had been to the record store 3 weeks prior every day saying, "Is it here yet? Is it here yet?" And they're like, "No, it's not coming out until..." But I would go back the next day and say, "Is it here yet?" And that anticipation, I think at that point I had heard her perform on the King Biscuit Flower Hour. And I had taped with one of those really bad secretary cheap cassette decks. I had held it up to the wall speaker and taped the King Biscuit Flower Hour of her performing live in Washington, and that was arresting. But nothing could prepare me for Birdland off of that first record.
In your book of photos of Patti Smith, you say that when you were 15 and you discovered her, you were a dork nerd. What qualified you for dork nerddom?
Well, I think I'm still kind of a geek, you know, and most of my really good friends are too. It's like there's that old adage that the world is divided into two types of people, those that snore and those that admit that they snore. Is that how it goes?
I don't know.
I can't remember. Anyway, I think we're all pretty geeky. You know, we're a pretty geeky species, and I'm just smart enough to admit it, I guess. But I didn't, you know, I think in high school I felt very much an outsider, and I didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere, and this music gave me a place where I felt like I fit in.
Now, I think that Patti Smith is perhaps among the few women in rock music who not only inspired other women to enter music, but inspired men too. I think men are kind of usually inspired by men in music to go into music, especially in rock. You know, there's always this big division in rock between, you know, the male thing and the female thing. So I'm wondering what it was like for you to be so inspired, you know, by a woman.
It didn't. I mean, I think there were definitely sexual elements to it, but it didn't make a difference to me that she was a woman. She was very androgynous,
right?
And the thing about her, I think, is that she was incredibly sexy, but she was very. She was very sexy as a woman. She was also very sexy as a man. She was, you know, she just kind of like blurred all those lines in a way that I don't think we had seen before, certainly from a female performer. And it just it didn't matter whether she was a man or a woman. It was in the music. It was in the energy of the songs and the words and what she was, what, you know, she was just so directly tapped into the source, and it was so glaringly obvious when compared to the other music that was around and that was available, that this person had tapped into something that was very uncommon and very unusual and very inspired.
Back in 1992, you told Rolling Stone magazine that no one has picked up on how much you've lifted from Patti Smith as a performer. What do you feel like you lifted from her as a performer?
Oh, well, just there were things about her vocal style that I really admired, and there was a certain freedom and looseness to almost a scatting quality that she has, and a fearlessness. I mean, more than anything, I think the fearlessness. That's not to say that throughout R.E.M.'s career I've really embodied that. I'm not sure that I have, but I think in moments here and there, we've produced stuff that has that same energy to it. Some of my favorite songs are the ones that really just seem like I didn't even know what happened. Suddenly there was a song and there were words, and somewhere in some very obtuse way they made sense.
In your book, you include some short essays by other people in the music world, including Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth, and he describes Patti Smith as the biggest influence on his creative life. He describes her as the most mythological and the most alien. He says, "I could not imagine talking to her face to face." I don't know if you felt that way about her or not, but she was this kind of hero to you, and then you met her as a person, a colleague in the music world. What was it like for you to go from knowing her as myth to knowing her as person?
Thurston and I are exactly the same age, and our experience with her music and with the music of the time and how it influenced us and the decisions that we made to start bands and to kind of stick with it exactly mirror one another. And I think in terms of meeting face to face someone that's had such a profound influence on you, when I talked with Thurston about what he wanted to write for the book, he related the story of having met Patti and Lenny and going out on the road with them, being in Kansas and going to visit Jack Kerouac's grave. And then one night in his hotel room, they're sitting up and talking and talking and talking and talking, and he had a headache and he was really tired and he just kind of wanted them to leave because he was really tired and wanted to go to sleep. And the contradiction there that as a 15 or 16-year-old, he would have probably given his left arm to be sitting in a room with Patti Smith and Lenny Kaye talking to him and telling stories, where in real life he just wanted to go to bed and make his headache go away. And that's a little bit what it's like, you know. I was very I was anxious about meeting her. I wasn't sure that we would even really like each other or get along. But it was one of those very instantaneous sparks. I mean, there was no doubt that it was just one of those things, you know. When you meet somebody, you know right away that it's really right and it's really good.
I'm sure a lot of people see you as being a mythic figure in their lives, and I wonder what it's like to be on that end of it when you meet them and they're giving their left arm to be with you in the same room.
I think I finally come to terms with that as a media figure, as a celebrity, as a singer, and I try to be very gracious with people when they come up and assume that they're, you know, maybe not able to say exactly what they want to say, if indeed they really are excited to meet me.
Do you ever worry that, I don't know, it seems to me when you're very famous that there's two things you could worry about. One is that it could have a really damaging effect on your ego, and the other is that it could make you more insecure that you're not going to measure up to these impossible expectations that people have.
Right. I think, Peter Buck put it best, and I've used this phrase ever since.
The guitarist with R.E.M.
Yeah, our guitar player. It's when you buy your own myth that you're really in trouble.
Right.
And I mean, I think it takes a certain type of ego to be a media figure and to be to front a rock band, certainly. And I don't deny that. But you know, I don't wake up in the morning and think of myself as an incredibly famous person or someone who's influential or anything. I just think that I need to brush my teeth, you know, and get some coffee.
My guest is Michael Stipe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Stipe, lead singer and songwriter of the band R.E.M. His new book, Two Times Intro, collects the photos he took of Patti Smith when he accompanied her on her 1995 tour with Bob Dylan. How did Patti Smith end up inviting you on this tour in which she was performing with Bob Dylan?
I was in New York doing some activist work and had been off the road. My band had toured for about a year, for the better part of a year in 95. And I had been off for 2 or 3 weeks and was going up to New York to do some activist work with this human rights organization. And Patti knew that I was going to be there because I invited her to go along with me. Well, she then, in turn, invited me to come out on a couple of shows. Bob Dylan had asked her to do a string of, I think it was 13 or 14 shows for 2 weeks around the Northeast, and she accepted. And it was kind of significant in that she had retired from live performance pretty much in 1979, I think, and had not really been on stage with a full band in, 17 years or 16 years. So she accepted, and she was wildly influenced by Dylan and really appreciates and admires him a great deal. So it was a compliment for him to ask her. And I had never really seen her perform live, and it was something I'd wanted to do, and so I jumped on the bus.
You had said at one point that Dylan didn't have the effect on you that he had on a lot of other people. I don't know how well you knew his music, but did you feel a responsibility to kind of bone up on Dylan music before joining the tour?
Well, I had felt that responsibility before we wrote a song called It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. And I didn't realize that I was kind of lifting a vocal thing from Dylan from a very famous song of his called Subterranean Homesick Blues. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Peter Buck said, you should probably listen to this record. And so I did, because I think he knew that as soon as our record came out, people were going to say, oh, you lifted this from Dylan. I know that I knew that song, and I know that I had heard it, but it wasn't a conscious lift.
Right.
So I had been exposed to his music. I just wasn't one of those diehard fans that had every record.
Your photos of Patti Smith are really, in a way, the opposite of Robert Mapplethorpe's photos of her on her album jackets, particularly different from that first very mythic cover on horses in which she is dressed so androgynously and looks so mysterious. I find your photos of her very, very casual and in the moment. I mean, it could almost be like anybody's friend. Do you know what I mean? She doesn't look like a hero. She doesn't look mythic in it. And is that something that you were going after? Or just a very kind of casual side of her?
Not really. I mean, in the 2 weeks, I carry my camera all the time. I take pictures constantly. And I didn't have the idea to put out a book of pictures until much later. But I was just snapping my friends. And I think Patti felt really relaxed with me taking pictures. And so she smiled a lot. Well, fast forward 3 years, about a month before the book came out, about a month and a half ago, a friend remarked that every picture of her in the book, she's smiling. And I had to go back and look at it, and I had not realized that every single photograph that I chose to go into the book, she's smiling or grinning. And that's a Patti Smith that we haven't really seen before.
Right.
It's an image of her that we haven't really seen before.
Michael Stipe is my guest, and his new book is called Two Times Intro, On the Road with Patti Smith. Well, I think it's time to listen to some more of your music, and I thought we'd start pretty close to the beginning and hear something from the first EP that R.E.M. released called Chronic Town. I think it was recorded in 81 and released in 82. And the song I thought we could hear from it is Wolves Lower. Would you say something about the song, about writing it, or about this moment in your life when it was recorded?
I don't really remember much about that. I was kind of nervous to be in the recording studio, and I hadn't really learned how to write words, so I'm not sure how many actual real words there are in the song, but it's got a nice vibe.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
Suspicion yourself, don't get caught. Suspicion yourself, let others out. At the door. In a corner
That's REM, my guest is singer Michael Stipe, singer and songwriter. So let's get back to when you were a teenager, when you just started singing. You were telling us that you didn't really think seriously about music till you were 15 and discovered Patti Smith. So when you started thinking that you were serious about music, what happened next? Did you start singing more?
Well, when I was 17, I guess, I answered an ad and joined a band that was, I guess, kind of like a punk rock cover band, pretty much. And we had a real good time. We never really played out in public very much. It was mostly just kind of a garage band. And then when I moved to Athens at the age of 18, I really, really wanted to find somebody that I could work with. And
this is Athens, Georgia that you met.
Athens, Georgia, yeah. And that's when I met Peter Buck, and he was very resistant to the idea of forming a band because he felt like people in bands were assholes, and he didn't want to be that. And he also didn't feel like he was a very good guitar player, which at the time he wasn't. But I didn't know how to sing and had never written a song in my life. So after months of urging, he finally caved in, and we started REM.
Michael Stipe, his new book of photos is called Two Times Intro, On the Road with Patti Smith. Michael Stipe will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. And Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox, speak, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down, high wire and a fire representing seven games in a government for hire. Fury's breathing down your neck. Team, my team reporters babble Trump, tethered crop. Look at that, no plane, fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow, population common food, but it'll do. Save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs. Listen to your heartbeat. Dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right. You patriotic, patriotic, slam, bite, bright, light, feeling, pretty sight. It's the end of the world as we know it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Michael Stipe of REM, and Maureen Corrigan reviews John Irving's new novel, A Widow for 1 Year.
Smash, smash, crack, push, whack, tie another one to the racks, baby. Hey, hey, kid, rock and roll, nobody tells you where to go. What if I ride? What if you walk? What if you rock around the clock? Tip, 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 tip. What if you did? What if you walk? What if you try to get on, baby? Hey, hey, kid, where are you? Nobody tells you what to do, baby. Hey, hey, kid, shake a leg. Maybe you're crazy in the head.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Michael Stipe, lead singer and songwriter with the band R.E.M. He has a new book of photos that he took of Patti Smith while he accompanied her on her 1995 tour with Bob Dylan. Before we continue the interview, let's hear R.E.M.'s first recording made in 1981, Radio Free Europe. In some of the R.E.M. recordings over the years, your voice is mixed kind of deep into the music,
yeah.
as opposed to being up front in front of the music.
Yeah.
And I, you know, me personally,
that's my insecurity coming out again.
Is it?
Well, yeah. And I at the time in the early '80s, everyone was mixing the drums louder than the vocal, and I just thought that was really embarrassing. We didn't want to be a disco band, and I was. Somewhat reacting to the music of the day, but I was also just kind of embarrassed because I'd never really, you know, the thought process of being a singer, being in a band, putting out a record, and then it's like, oh, whoops, well, I've got to write words because people expect words, and then, oh, well, the words should make sense. And, I mean, if you listen to our records starting with Wolves Lower, which we just heard, and progressing, the first really three or four records, including Chronic Town, you're basically watching four guys learn how to write songs, and you're watching me learn how to write a lyric, and I find that kind of fascinating. You know, those records mean a whole lot to a lot of people. Sometimes they're a little hard for me to listen to, but I do appreciate them for what they are.
Right. I'm wondering if you were influenced by any soul singers too.
I think I must have been, but I can't think of anybody right on. Growing up as a child, my parents were not huge music fans. It was like a lot of Gershwin and Mancini and the 1812 Overture with real cannons and what else?
Well, your father's in the military.
The Sound of Music, yeah.
Oh,
But we lived in Texas for a stint, and mm-hmm. There was country radio, and that was bubblegum, when bubblegum pop radio was really big. And so that was certainly an influence. I didn't really have an older brother or sister that turned me on to the Beatles and turned me on to the Who and turned me on to all the music of the '60s, and so, you know, I kind of discovered stuff via radio as a child, and then really up until I found that magazine article on Hurt Horses, I was just kind of coasting along. I mean, I think before that, the only one musical artist that I thought was really interesting was Elton John. When Benny and the Jets came out, I thought that was one of the most amazing, and I still do. For me, Benny and the Jets and Rock On by David Essex are two of the most amazing. They'd be in my top 10 of best pop songs ever.
Now, I know because your father was in military, you moved around a lot as a kid, mm-hmm. as he got transferred to different military bases. What impact did it have on you to always be the new kid in the neighborhood?
Well, the positive aspects are that my family and I are very close, and when you're forced to make new friends fairly regularly, it kind of brings you together as a unit. I hate that word. Well, anyway, we were a great loving family and very close, and we still are, and that's about the greatest gift that could ever be given to me, is to have my two sisters, my mom and dad, be very supportive and to unconditionally, you know, love me the way that they have all along. And, of course, that's returned.
How old were you when you left home?
17 or 18.
Was that go to college?
Yeah. And then my parents moved away, and then I followed them because I got really poor.
So you were broke, so you moved back in with your parents? Is that what you
said? Yeah.
And where was that?
In Athens.
Oh, they were in Athens too. I see.
Yeah. Well, no, they moved to Athens from St. Louis, and I stayed in St. Louis because I thought it was very urban and very, you know, punk rock, and I thought Athens was kind of a cow town and a bunch of hippies eating cucumber sandwiches, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I moved in with these guys that were in a band, in a punk band, and we ate spaghetti with butter for about 3 months, and I continued my schooling, and then I really ran out of money, and finally drove to Georgia and joined my family. And they were living in a trailer park at the time, trying to find a house that they could move into. So I moved into the house when they finally found it, lived with my parents for about 9 months, and then moved out and moved into the church where we started the band.
Yeah, Athens had a storied reputation in alternative rock for a while because of your group and the B-52s and a couple of other groups that came out of there. Did you think there was musically anything special about Athens, or that just coincidentally a few good musicians happened to be there?
Well, it's a pretty creative community. It's a small town, fairly liberal, in a somewhat conservative state, and it's a university town, so there's a lot of people coming and going a lot. There's a it's got a great history of, you know, a lot of hippies were there in the 60s. There was a lot of civil rights stuff going on in the 60s, and there was always kind of a strong underground of people that would come out to see, you know, if someone had an exhibit or someone had some kind of performance, or if a band played in a club or in a space, you know, there would always be an audience to kind of support them, however good or bad they were.
When you started performing, what were your like rock values? You know, the things that you really loved about rock, the things that you never wanted to become that you'd seen other bands become.
My band always, I feel like a kind of like a broken record because I say this so much, but it's really the truth. We always kind of operated by process of negation. We knew everything that we didn't want to be. And the things that were left were our options. And we were fortunate enough to be a small band that had to work very, very hard to get to the place that we finally got to. And we also had no expectations, no goals. So every time that we had a success, it was kind of a surprise, and we were all kind of like thrown back by it. And it kind of took us to the top of the heap, which was a pretty cool place to be.
What didn't you want to be?
I didn't want to buy my own myth. I didn't want to be a cliche. I didn't want to be typical or mediocre.
Let me play another REM track, and I think I'll choose one of your most famous recordings, your big hit, Losing My Religion. Is there a story behind this song?
Yeah. I was embarrassed about it at the time, but I finally fessed up to being a huge fan of the song Every Breath You Take by The Police. And I thought that song was like really kind of an intense, it was a beautiful pop song, and it was very lovely, but you could take it more than one way. It seemed very kind of creepy and obsessive on one hand, and very kind of like intense and loving on the other hand. And I wanted to write a song that was like that. So I wrote Losing My Religion.
Okay, well, this is it.
Corner. That's me in the spot.
That's REM. My guest is lead singer and songwriter Michael Stipe. You know, I think a lot of people have a personal story to tell about that song, particularly about the lines, "Oh no, I've said too much, I haven't said enough." I think a lot of people have stories about times when they really weren't sure about whether they've said too much or said enough. Do you have a story that matches with those lines?
Well, no, I didn't really take it from any real life situation. I just think it was more about fear of rejection, you know, and when you're like really crazy about somebody and you want to tell them, but you're trying to give them hints and then they're maybe not getting it, or they're saying something back to you and you're taking it the wrong way. And that's really, it's that kind of weird, uneasy area is what that song kind of covers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very successful. I really like the song a lot.
Oh, me too. I'm glad you still like it. A lot of people get tired of their own hits. Then they get angry with you if you play them.
Yeah, no. It's a good song.
And you still play it in performances?
We try to. Yeah, we do.
My guest is Michael Stipe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Stipe, lead singer and songwriter of the band REM. His new book, Two Times Intro, collects the photos he took of Patti Smith when he accompanied her on her 1995 tour with Bob Dylan. How do you think fame has affected the band? You know, you're talking about all the values you didn't want to have, and I think there are some values that become almost difficult to avoid once the spotlight hits.
Yeah. The guys have always been really supportive of me being the front person, and the fact that I would get more attention and I would be the one that photographers wanted to take pictures of or wanted to push to the front of the picture. And that I'm the one that gets recognized in restaurants or, you know, when we walk down the street or whatever. They've always been really, really supportive. I know that Bill, before he quit the band, our drummer, always said that he wouldn't trade places with me for anything in the world, and sometimes really felt sorry for me because he would be able to say, you know, he'd be able to say, call a restaurant and say, I'm in REM, or call, you know, the baseball people and say, I'd like tickets, I'm in REM, and they would give them to him where he could go anonymously into that restaurant or into the baseball place. I maybe couldn't, and especially after losing my religion, because that was really, that was a song that really made us international, you know, pop stars, if you will. And at that point, you know, I really had to kind of come to terms with that because I was being recognized just about everywhere that I went. And that can kind of throw you, you know.
Well, the shame.
But I had had whatever 13 years of being in a band and being a star in my own head to kind of build up to that. So it wasn't that horrible.
Right. I'm sure, you know, like shaving your head also helped people recognize you.
Yeah, it was easier when I could grow my hair different lengths, but my hair started to fall out, so I shaved it off.
Right. When you started performing and you were much more insecure about yourself as a songwriter and a singer, I think your on-stage style was different too. Would you talk about what your on-stage style was like early on?
Well, people told me, I remember there was a point where I decided I didn't want to move for an entire tour. So I stood at the microphone and I thought it would be very intense, and it was, it worked. But prior to that, I think I just flailed myself around the stage a lot. I know I whiplashed myself a couple times between 1980 and 1983. I'm still suffering the consequences of that. But I don't know. I just had long. I had really bad skin, so I grew my hair as long as I could and wore it over my face. And I'd wear makeup to kind of like raccoon my eyes, or I'd wear glasses, but they would get steamed up, so I couldn't do that after a while. And I would just put a lot of clothes on because somehow that felt, you know, like it was protecting me. I'm still, you know, even this morning I did Regis and Kathy Lee, and they were so sunshine happy, you know, that, and
they were just glad to see you.
I mean, they were very glad to see me. I was really, you know, I was happy to go on the show, but they were like a gale force, and they made me blush, you know, because they were kind of, yelling nice things at me about what I've done and what I've accomplished, and it was really embarrassing. So I kind of blushed on right there in front of the TV cameras. I think that. Oh, I forgot the question.
Well, we were talking about how your performance style has changed.
Oh.
You were talking about covering up your face with your hair when you were younger.
At a point, you know, I didn't have hair to cover my face up with, so I kind of had to do something else. And, you know, the audiences got bigger and bigger and bigger, and you tend to... I got to the point where I didn't want to be the guy in the back row because it seemed like a really, you know, kind of crap seat to be watching a band from. So your gestures get bigger or you try to bring the lights up a little bit, or you try to wear light colored clothing so they can see you, and I don't know, whatever. You know, you try to... I was just trying to make everybody feel like they got their money's worth when they came to see us perform.
Michael Stipe is my guest, and he has a new book of photos that he took on the road with Patti Smith. Often on the show, when we have a performer on, I ask them to redeem or resurrect a song, to choose a song that you really love that a lot of people might think of as just too square, really bad, but you think there's actually something really quite wonderful about it. Is there such a song for you that you would like to name that you could either, you know, just sing a few bars of, or we could play a recording of?
The two songs that I mentioned earlier, Rock On by David Essex and Benny and the Jets by Elton John, I think are really amazing songs. Also, I mean, for me, the song on horses that really did it was Birdland. And that was just, that was musically that took me to a place that I had never been to in my life.
Well, maybe go ahead.
I'll never forget the experience of hearing that for the first time. And I know that, you know, in my heart, and I can speak for my band on this one, that, you know, when we make records, we want the same thing for whoever's out there listening to it. I want it to take them somewhere that they've never been before, and I want them to, like, have had some kind of experience that has some impact on them, and hopefully a good one. You know, it's in a way kind of passing the baton.
Well, maybe this would be a good place to play Birdland, since your new book is a book of pictures of Patti Smith. So why don't we hear that?
Great.
But nobody heard the boys cry of alarm. Nobody there, except for the birds around the New England farm. And they gathered in all directions like roses they scattered. And they were like compass grass coming together into the head of a shaman bouquet. Shooting, and he saw the lights of traffic beckoning him like that. Hands of Blake grabbing at his cheeks, taking at his neck, all his limbs. Everything was twisted, and he said, "Ah, won't give up, won't give up. Don't let me give up, I won't give up. Come here, let me go up fast. Take me up quick, take me."
Patti Smith, and my guest is Michael Stipe, whose new book is a book of photos of Patti Smith on tour. Your new book is a new book of photographs of Patti Smith. You've been photographed a lot over the years. How do you feel when you're the one being photographed? Is that an uncomfortable situation for you, and what's it like for you to see pictures of yourself?
If I like the photographer, then I'm really, really comfortable with it. If I don't know the photographer, then, you know, I have kind of like one kind of Andy Warhol face that I've used all along, and really didn't realize that I was doing that until about 3 years ago. But I enjoy being photographed. I think it's really fun.
I think the word that's most often used to describe you is the word enigmatic.
I hate that word.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it's stupid. I mean, I hate that word. That word followed me for years and years and years, and... you know, I did say early on, and I did feel, and I still do, that, you know, an air of mystery around certainly a public figure, but also just in life. is not altogether a bad thing, that you don't ever want to really give everything away. And at whatever point you do, you know, it might be too much.
Michael Stipe, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Michael Stipe, his new book of photos is called Two Times Intro, On the Road with Patti Smith.
When your day is long and the night is yours alone, when you're sure you've had enough of this life, yourself go. Cause everybody cries, everybody hurts sometimes.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews John Irving's new novel. This is Fresh Air. Ever since the 1978 publication of The World According to Garp, the balancing of the catastrophic and the comic has become novelist John Irving's narrative trademark. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that in his latest novel, called A Widow for 1 Year, Irving's long-running balancing act is as audacious and breathtaking as ever.
It's hard to imagine how a novel that includes the accidental deaths of two teenage boys, the abandonment of a child, a divorce, a rape, a suicide, and a murder could, at its conclusion, cause a reader to recall Robert Browning's famously reassuring lines, "God's in his heaven, all's right with the world." But John Irving's latest wayward wonder of a book does just that. Although bad things happen to good people in A Widow for 1 Year, the novel ultimately affirms a cosmic symmetry in which good and evil eternally seesaw back and forth. Like the great Victorians whose works his own sprawling books consciously resemble, Dickens, Eliot, Thackeray, Irving is an author god whose grand fictional designs encompass the whole of life. A Widow for 1 Year opens in a death-haunted house and ends 4 decades later with a wedding in that very same house. In between, characters and storylines intersect, collide, and split apart with the kind of antic grace that makes an awestruck reader fall down and worship. Irving has divided A Widow for 1 Year into 3 parts. Part 1 takes place in the summer of 1958, in a house in the Hamptons inhabited by Ted Cole, a writer of scary books for children, and his beautiful wife Marion. Since the death of their teenage son several years before, the couple has drifted apart. Marion has become obsessed with the hundreds of photographs of her sons that she's hung around the house. Ted has applied himself to the serial seduction of young mothers whose children adore his books. Lost in the emotional gulf between the Coles is their 4-year-old daughter, Ruth, who will grow up to become the novel's compelling main character and a renowned Irving-like novelist in her own right. Our ruefully omniscient narrator tells us that a likely source of Ruth's imagination was that she grew up in a house where the photographs of her dead brothers were a stronger presence than any presence she detected in either her mother or her father. Rounding out this uneasy company is a 16-year-old Exeter student named Eddie O'Hare. Crafty Ted has hired Eddie, ostensibly to be his assistant, but really to become Marion's lover and thus ease the way for a divorce. The fact that Eddie looks like one of the Coles' dead sons does indeed make him irresistible to Marion, and the couple enjoys weeks of record-breaking sex until Marion, with good cause, vanishes. For almost 40 years, Eddie will carry a torch for her. Part one of A Widow for 1 Year is so marvelous, moving on requires an act of readerly fortitude. After all, what can possibly top the bittersweet silliness of the scene where Marion first seduces Eddie under the Exeter motto, "Come hither, boys, and become men"? And the insertion of the full texts of Ted's creepy children's books are as transfixing as any Edward Gorey tale. But as Eddie will learn, one can dwell in the past for only so long, and forging ahead into part two, which takes place in the fall of 1990, and part three, the fall of 1995, offers tremendous rewards. We come to know the adult Ruth and tag along with her as she conducts firsthand research for her next novel in Amsterdam's red light district. Best of all, we get to watch as Irving wraps up about a zillion loose plot ends in a conclusion that affords all of the characters we care about some of their just desserts. If only real life would resolve itself into such satisfying order. That's the other similarity between Irving and his Victorian mentors. Like Dickens and company, Irving upholds a sturdy utopianism in his novels. Life, as his characters experience it, may not always be fair or kind, but it's full of variety and surprise, as well as a divine assurance that what goes around eventually comes around.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed John Irving's new novel, A Widow for 1 Year. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf, Alan Tu, and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.